sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Rebecca Einstein Shore, co-editor of the book The Sacred Calling, commemorating 40 years of women in the rabbinate. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This has been a busy few weeks in July. My wife Wendy and I went on vacation to France. We were in Paris for Bastille Day, the French national holiday. And on the morning of July 14th, the newspaper headlines in Le Monde and elsewhere highlighted a scandal involving French President François Hollande. He is accused of employing a hairdresser to cut and style his hair at the cost to the French treasury of over 9,000 euros a month, roughly $10,000 a month, as much as a cabinet minister makes. Hollande is a socialist who became president in part by claiming he would make the job more normal and less imperial. Apparently, his hair was not covered by that campaign promise. But by the end of the night, things had changed dramatically in Paris. We went to see the fireworks show at the Eiffel Tower, celebrating Bastille Day. It was a great show indeed, wonderful pinwheels of fire and color all up and down the famous landmark, carefully coordinated with wonderful thematic music. There were many, many thousands of thrilled spectators, mostly French, and large numbers of heavily armed French troops and police controlling the area good-naturedly. But when we returned to our hotel room after the great show, we learned of the horrific attack on the Bastille Day celebrations in Nice, the murder of 84 people, including many children, with over 200 more innocents wounded. Shortly after those events, and a bit after midnight in Paris, there was François Hollande on the TV news wearing a suit, speaking movingly about how terrorism would not defeat France. France is afflicted, he said, but she is strong. She will always be stronger than the fanatics who want to strike her today. He emphasized that Bastille Day celebrated France's deep dedication to liberty and freedom. And his hair looked perfect. Even more than the United States in the last couple of years, France has been the epicenter of terror attacks on the free nations of the West. From the Charlie Hebdo massacre at the satirical magazine that dared lampoon Islamic fanatics, to the hyper-kosher murders tied to those, and the hostage-taking in a kosher supermarket in Paris, to the horrifying carnage in November in the streets of Paris last year, Islamist terror attacks have targeted France above all. France has technically been in a state of emergency since the November attacks. It will likely continue to be so now for some time. The net effect is to provide much more military presence in civilian settings and much more security in places like Paris. But apparently that didn't help much on the famous Promenade des Anglais in Nice, where the Bastille Day attack was perpetrated. A few observations about the terror onslaught in France. First, having been there for 2 weeks this month, I can tell you that reports of the country being in some sort of martial law lockdown or overrun by crazed Islamist fighters is completely inaccurate. It remains France, and Paris remains Paris. Incredible food, beautiful scenery and cityscapes, fashionable and beautiful people, incredible art and culture and atmosphere. Terrorism in Syria and Iraq has destroyed the fabric of those societies. Not so in France, just as it's not true here in America. Secondly, there have been so many wild reports that the Jewish community of France is leaving en masse for Israel or Canada or America. Not so. I have had conversations with sophisticated Jews here in America since I've returned who were shocked that there even is a French Jewish community. Well, it's not only in existence, it's the largest Jewish community in Europe and one of the most vibrant in the world. Is there great concern there about Islamist terrorism, particularly about the rising tide of primarily Islamic-backed anti-Semitism in France? Of course. But the enormous majority of the Jews of France are not leaving their very lovely country. France has great challenges responding to terror attacks in its complicated nation. Those terror attacks will not destroy France or force the French Jewish community to leave. Terrorism is ultimately a futile and even counterproductive weapon. True, it destroys human lives and societal harmony in free societies, but it inevitably reinforces the most authoritarian aspects of those same democratic societies that are attacked, and it provides terrorists with no true tangible gains. Just ask the Palestinians. They embraced terrorism fully 50 and more years ago. They still have no country and no healthy society to base a country on. And the Western societies that have been attacked, like America and France, continue to flourish in spite of the ongoing atrocities of the terrorists. Thank God. To play us in this morning, here's a song from a new Israeli sensation, Elkanah Marciano. His song, appropriate to this confused age, Sea of Confusion, Yam Shel Gagua.
בין השתיקות לבין העצב חיפשתי לי פינה שקטה ללב לדבר מעט עם אלוקים כשהכאב סורב בפנים בחיים אני הבנתי עם הזמן בסוף הכל עובר עלייך מבטל, אני עוד אתגבר אני הולך ממך פגוע איתך עבדו לי התקווה נותר בים של גגוע לחיבוקים לנשיקות שלך כל רגע כל שנייה היית אצלי במוח אבל עכשיו אני
That was Elkanah Marciano, his song Yam Shel Gagua, Sea of Confusion. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rabbi Rebecca Einstein Shore, will tell us what prompted the creation of the new book, The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Rabbi Rebecca Einstein Shore is the editor, co-editor, I guess, of The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate, a spanking new publication from the Central Conference of American Rabbis, dealing with the whole issue of women in the rabbinate from a wide variety of perspectives. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning and thank you so much for having me.
So some of us can remember when there weren't women rabbis. 40 years, it's a remarkable, not very long in Jewish history, but, you know, kind of long in human history. Tell us a little bit about how this book evolved.
Exactly. So so we're actually just having celebrated the 44th year since the ordination of Rabbi Sally Priesand. And about I want to say 5 years ago, so it was right before the actual 40th anniversary, there was this idea floated that there is a lot that has happened that went into the decision, but in the four decades since, not just in the liberal Jewish community, but also in other streams of Judaism. And let's take a really hard look and see what's happened so far, what are the areas where there is still work that needs to be done, and even take a look and see, was there any other type of historical precedence for women assuming the mantle of rabbinic leadership? And I think that was one area for me that I found the most surprising, going all the way back to Talmudic times, even looking at the early Hasidic movement and seeing the ways some women rose to positions of leadership. And there's something really a little bit for everyone in this book. We have authors from across the Jewish community all the way, of course, in the Reform movement, but even going into modern Orthodox and talking about some of the really exciting and thrilling advances women have made there as well. And it's just the width and breadth of this book is stunning.
You know, in 1972, when Sally Priestheim was ordained, the whole concept of a woman rabbi, although there were, as the book highlights, certain pioneers, but not many, was really revolutionary. If you had told me that in long before the Messiah came, there would be a modern Orthodox woman rabbi ordained, I would never have believed you. And yet, Sarah Horwitz and others have now been ordained. It's no longer a matter of novelty. This is simply a fact of life in the Jewish world, isn't it?
I would agree that in many quarters, it is now just a matter of fact part of Jewish life. I think it is still a novelty in, the further right we go in our community. Obviously, it still is a relatively shocking big deal, because every time a woman is hired at a modern Orthodox or open Orthodox synagogue, it gets a lot of press and a lot of airtime, because it is, just as it was for us 40 years ago, so revolutionary. That's how they're experiencing it now, and I imagine it's that way in any area where there is some type of groundbreaking change, such as the one we've had. I mean, if we were to go back to a time when only men were doctors, when a woman would receive her medical degree, it was quite revolutionary. It wasn't the norm. It was really pushing back against societal expectations. I want to say on a fairly regular basis, have people tell me, both Jewish and non-Jewish, oh, I didn't know women could be rabbis. And we're more than 40 years into it now. So it really depends, I think, where you are in the country, certainly. I have never worked in a synagogue where there hadn't already been a woman in some capacity on the bima. So for me, I have never felt like it was very groundbreaking, but I have colleagues who have gone into communities where the mere notion of a woman being able to be a rabbi is still met with statements such as, well, you know, that's very nice that you're the rabbi, but who's going to sign the ketubah for my son's wedding?
Right.
who's going to, I can't have you do my mother's funeral, rabbi, because my father doesn't think women should be rabbis. So a lot of that still exists, even though one would think after four decades that we've moved past that.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Rebecca Shore, the co-editor of The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes. The base ingredients, the propylene glycol vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com. Stream them from there or download them from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We now have 3.5 months until we elect a new president of these United States. We continue our 2016 to Jewish Presidential Report. The Republican National Convention was held in Cleveland last week, and it was, well, something. What? I'm not sure, but it was something. A number of Republican notables were absent, including a sizable number of prominent Jewish Republicans, many of whom also seem to be sitting out the funding part of the Trump Presidential Express so far. Sheldon Adelson, the Jewish casino owner and perhaps the largest Republican megadonor, has pledged to support Trump lavishly, but as of yet, the money has not appeared in, you know, actual cash. While it remains to be seen what the overall impact of this Republican convention will be, the Democratic convention is coming up this week in Florida, one aspect of Donald Trump's approach to publicity was on full display. That was his unique ability to pretend major mistakes don't matter or weren't mistakes in the first place. We have seen this tendency, as Jews, in his non-responses to the support he's received from rabidly anti-Semitic bloggers and social media types, and his initial denials that there was anything untoward in that aberrant post, which had a Jewish star next to Hillary Clinton with the phrase "most corrupt candidate ever" emblazoned inside of it. Trump is now the official Republican nominee for President of the United States. We can certainly hope that he will now approach the ridiculous and sometimes vicious anti-Semitic statements coming from some of his followers with the same forceful bluntness he uses to address everything and everyone else. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about colonialism last week, and you mentioned the Dutch and the Belgian colonies and sort of the different interpretations of what it means to be part of a colonial empire. And we rejected, I think, right off the bat that Israel's not a colony. It wasn't founded by a foreign power and implanted into the Middle East. There were the great rivalries of the 19th century between the British and the French.
Right. But we, just to clarify that point, I don't think anybody ever says that Israel is a colony. I think they claim that it's a colonialist power.
Oh, no. I've heard people say it's like a Jewish colony in the Arab Middle East.
Okay, maybe. But I've heard it described
as a colonial power because of the control of the West Bank.
As being colonialist. Right. And I think that's clearly not the case. But anyway, right. Britain and France. You know, Britain and France scrambled to control all of Africa, to control much of Southeast Asia. They really rivaled each other almost tit for tat, also in the Caribbean.
And of course, the century before here in North America.
So. Right. So what's interesting is, particularly if you go, let's say, to West Africa, where there's almost a random scattering of one country's English and one country's French and the next country's English and the next country's French. There are a lot of small countries on the coast.
With a little bit of Spanish somewhere mixed in occasionally.
Yeah, but I mean, the serious rivals were Britain and France, and they left very different kinds of legacies, and they rationalized their presence and conceived of their mission in very different terms. The French had this term, and all these terms sound horribly racist to our ears today, but not in the 18th and 19th centuries. These were like noble kind of religious callings. The French referred to their mission as la mission civilisatrice, the civilizing mission, bringing light into darkness, bringing enlightenment to unenlightened people, and bringing the Bible to non-Christians. The British, to an even greater extent, But they called it, and this sounds much more blatantly racist, the white man's burden.
Right. That Rudyard Kipling's famous poem, Pick Up the White Man's Burden.
And a lot of Brits, particularly the Scots, really sacrificed their health, their lives, their spouses, their children to settle in very unhealthy climates long before there was modern medicine and immunizations and stuff. And a lot of them died in order to bring light into darkness as they saw it. Now, in fairness, the Brits did leave a lot of lasting institutions and infrastructure. India has a wonderful railway system, a wonderful court system. You know, nothing's perfect, but the Brits left a legacy in many places of which they can be quite proud. The French left a different kind of legacy, not necessarily better or worse, just very different. I mean, British cuisine, I don't need to comment on. If you want to eat in Britain, you have to go to an Indian restaurant or an Italian restaurant. You can't really go to a British restaurant. So that, they're in their colonies, there's no real tradition of British food at all.
Thank God.
And the French colonies, on the other hand, in a small town in the Côte d'Ivoire, you can find a French cafe and pâtisserie that has good croissants, good baguettes, decent meals, even in the smallest places. The French left at least that. They also often intermarried. They were much less sort of racist or exclusive than the Brits were. So there are a lot of couples which are half African and half French, and they often run restaurants, hotels, bakeries, whatever. So the French left a different kind of legacy, and the attitudes towards those two colonial powers are very different. We should probably talk about our own hemisphere maybe during our next session.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi non-Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Well, there's a very interesting appointment in the Israeli government. It's now a couple months old. Bibi Netanyahu appointed Avigdor Lieberman as defense minister. Now, defense minister is a huge deal in Israel, and Lieberman had never served in the army. I know Israelis have all kinds of perspectives on him, but give us a personal perspective on this.
It's not a secret that he was nominated not for his
military expertise.
Bibi wanted a bigger coalition, and he, you know, just for the background. And he, first of all, referred to Buzi Herzog.
He tried to make a deal with what's left of labor.
Yeah, exactly. And after not succeeding, and really without the ability to run the government with like only 61 members of the government, he offered it to Lieberman. And I think the majority of the Israeli, without even sending a poll, okay, to all the Israelis, the majority of the Israeli really don't like, think that it's even ridiculous.
Even for Israeli politics, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, right? Because we had once, you know, Amir Peretz,
right,
when he was the minister. Yeah, right. And he has no military background, like rich background as a general, which...
No, I think he was like a corporal, yeah, or a sergeant or something. He was a non-commissioned officer.
Bidiuk. At the end, he did great, great job by bringing the Iron Dome to Israel.
Like, right, the Iron Dome. He was the one who was
pivotal. We remember this as a good thing he did while he was a defense minister. But it's not just the lack of skills or the, his personality, but it's also his approach towards, you know, peace process and being very radical about almost everything. So it's kind of scary, you know. You want someone to run
the military.
The military. And even if you think like the last thing that happened with the soldier in Hebron.
Right. Right.
You know,
how would Lieberman have responded?
Bidiuk, Boogie was the one, and I appreciate him for that, to say that we have to. It's not a luxury.
This is the guy who shot the Palestinian as he was lying on the ground. He went up to him. He was incapacitated, and he shot him in the head, killed him.
Nachon. And I agree with Boogie that in order for us to survive, we need to keep a high moral. Like a high standard of it, we can't say
Toharat HaNeshek, they talk about
Bidiyuk, the purity of arms, right? And a lot of Jewish values, you know. And I don't
and
know
Lieberman
how...
instead immediately came up in favor of the... He stood with the soldier when he was arraigned for murder, you know.
Biduke.
Not the right image.
And how Israel will be pictured in the world if he will support these kind of things. Oh, my God.
You know, it's a politics makes strange bedfellows is a phrase. You put people together, then you put people in positions you don't think they should succeed. We all hope he does better in this than we think he will.
Oh, believe me, we hope that he will succeed in
this. He wasn't nearly as bad a foreign minister as we expected he would be, Lieberman, but this is an even more sensitive position.
I agree.
Thanks so much, Ashraf. We'll talk next week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or.
Well, it's getting close to school time.
Dun, dun, dun.
As soon as July is over in Tucson and Arizona, lots of parts of the world.
Right.
In the early part of August, you're back in school.
Yep.
What kinds of things should parents, grandparents, kids be thinking about as we get close to going back to school?
Sure. Well, think about how exciting and fun a new school year is going to be, because we're all excited to see everybody coming back. It's a great joy to see kids return over the summer, taller, looking sharper, looking wiser, more mature, more grown up. And of course, families love to bring those kiddos back to school after the summer break too. So yes, it is still July, I know, but it is time to be thinking back to school because it's right around the corner.
Wow. So in addition to getting backpacks and I don't know what school supplies consist of
all
today
kinds of
anymore.
Supplies are needed out there. And hopefully the organization you're part of has a supply list. But I think also what's important is to really be positive in celebrating the start of the new school year. And that can be done in a lot of ways. First of all, if families have some kind of concern or a question or fear or anxiety, reach out to your administration, reach out to your teachers, and be in contact. Share what's on your mind so that whatever's going on can be addressed together, and that, you know, you don't just carry it around and ruminate and mull on it and make the problem bigger and bigger in your head than it just might be. So reach out, be proactive, send an email, pick up the phone, and have a conversation if there's something you're worried about for next year. There's a lot that happens early in the school year, and we tend to forget that it's an intense time. Schedules are changing, routines are being kind of reacclimated to, and often there are new routines for families driving around town, and there are after-school programming and, you know, clubs and offerings to be thinking about too. So remembering that whole package and taking steps early to decide, oh, we want to try this out in the fall after school, or I'm really interested in accomplishing these goals at school. Who do I talk to about that? Those are really good strategies. And being prepared with that shopping list.
Yeah.
If you can consolidate that shopping list onto a one sheet or something in your phone that makes it easy is a real good strategy too.
So one more point, just to follow up on something you said, if you think there's a challenge, there's a problem, there's a learning disability or a relationship with a teacher you're concerned about, you know, the worst thing as an administrator, as a rabbi in a synagogue, to hear about something after someone was so upset that they left or didn't like it. If you let us know early on, we will work to make sure
that we can
fix
that. We want to work on
that.
I mean, it's what we do, right? We're here to solve problems together. We're not perfect, but we work hard to find great solutions. And it's also nice to come and see the school.
Yeah.
If the child is new to the school or the program, come down, walk around, get a little acclimated.
Sounds great. John, thanks. And happy back to schooling.
Happy back to school, everybody. We'll see you soon.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. After 12 years of therapy, my psychiatrist said something that brought tears to my eyes. He said, "No hablo inglés." Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and find a psychiatrist who speaks English. And now a word of Torah. The nation of Turkey has been all over the news the last week or so with its abortive coup, with President Erdogan retaining power. It reminded me of an unusual experience I had a few years back. On a visit to Istanbul, I visited Topkapi Palace, center of power for the mighty Ottoman Empire from 1450 to the 1800s, 400 years in which they dominated a huge portion of the globe. I had not been in Istanbul for a while, and they had built a new section of the large museum within Topkapi's ancient walls. They called it the Chamber of Sacred Relics. While Topkapi Palace is literally filled with rooms and objects of great historical and religious importance, carefully curated with dates and sources, this particular area is actually put together by a Muslim religious agency. It includes what can only be called a collection of pious forgeries and frauds. As tourists shuffle past the elegantly lit displays arrayed behind thick bulletproof glass, they learn they are viewing the cooking pot of Abraham, the turban of Joseph, Aaron the high priest's breastplate, King David's armor, Muhammad's sword and tooth, and a hair from his beard. I think they might have even had a footprint of Noah's in preserved rock. In imitation of the medieval Christian veneration of fake religious objects in ornate reliquaries, each of these pseudo-relics is reverently presented with an appropriate biblical verse from the Tanakh, or the New Testament, or the Quran. Each is treated as though it were the Hope Diamond, or a sultan's bejeweled coronation robe. It is quite ridiculous. I mean, next door you can see amazing actual jewel-encrusted thrones that sultans really did use. So why waste your time with these obvious fakes? What's notable is that the most impressive object among all these faux elements of supposed religious history is the staff of Moses. Now, in its Turkish incarnation in this museum, this staff is a golden rod about waist high with entwined serpents on it. It has a majestic but slightly dangerous look to it. In the Torah, this staff is a mysterious object. When Moses carries it in the wilderness of Sinai as a youngish shepherd, it is just a wooden stick. But he learns from God in the burning bush episode that it will turn into a snake when cast on the ground. And when he does this before Pharaoh, it turns out that Pharaoh's magicians can work the same trick. But Moses' snake stick swallows theirs. The same mateh, that's the word for it, is used by Moses, under God's direction, to part the Sea of Reeds and allow the Israelites to cross. He then lowers it to drown the Egyptian pursuers. It is the same stick used to strike the rock and bring water to the thirsty tribes, and it is held up in Moses' hand to help the Israelites triumph over their enemies in war. The powerful, multi-purpose staff even proves to be Moses' own undoing, for when directed to talk to a rock instead of hitting it with a stick, he can't resist whacking the stone to bring forth water, and so loses his entry ticket to the promised land. In short, Moses' mateh is an amazing tool indeed. You can see why the fakers at the Istanbul Chamber of Ancient Relics and Topkapi Palace wanted to claim its power for their own. But that omits one crucial detail. The mateh of Moses, that staff, is really just a stick. It's only when God chooses to command him to use it that it becomes something more. Which brings us to this week's Torah portion of Matot. The name comes from one of the two words used in the Torah for a tribe of Israel, Mateh, which means rod. The other word, Shevet, means branch. Both are really references to the staffs used to designate officials who lead the people. Branches of Moses' own staff of authority, if you will. As we near the conclusion of the book of Numbers, which completes the actual narrative of the journeys of the Israelites through the wilderness to the borders of the promised land, Moses is instructed by God to have the Israelites make a census of the tribes, a new count for those who are to enter Israel and make it their homeland. In Matot, the tribes are arranged and a census taken according to their staffs, like Moses' own staff, his mateh. In effect, they are counted by their sticks. But, like Moses' magic staff, the importance, relevance, and effectiveness of these sticks is based entirely on how God chooses to use them. Our sacred power, our magic, if you will, derives solely from God. We are all, in our own way, instruments of divine will. We only really count in this world when we serve God. May we remember this essential truth without recourse to magic or legend. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Rebecca Einstein-Shore, will explore the evolution of the role of women in the rabbinate and tell us what prompted the creation of the monumental new book, The Sacred Calling, when we return in a moment here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Sandy Seltzer.
The City Council of Amsterdam, Holland, has approved the construction of a memorial wall commemorating the 102,000 Dutch Jews killed by the Nazis, the highest percentage of Jews in any Western European country occupied by the Nazis to meet their deaths during World War II. The wall, as well as a Holocaust museum, will be located in what was the original Jewish district of Amsterdam. Aside from the Anne Frank House, until now, no other permanent tribute to those victims or living history of the Jews of Holland exists. The Anti-Defamation League and the Union for Reform Judaism have deplored the statement in the Republican Party's platform, adopted in Cleveland, which omits support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, noting that it has been the official policy of all American presidents, Republican and Democrat alike, for decades. The platform also refers to Jerusalem as Israel's indisputable capital and rejects any reference to Israel's presence in the West Bank as an occupation. And the chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations in the United States has called upon President Obama's press secretary, Joshua Earnest, to apologize for comparing the appointment of Boris Johnson as Britain's new foreign minister with the naming of Ron Dermer as Israel's ambassador to this country. Calling it a gratuitous comment, he added, "We are disappointed and dismayed. These are two unrelated events, and the comparison is unfounded." And that's the two Jewish news.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Rebecca Einstein-Shore is the co-editor of The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate. By the way, you're not really a co-editor, you're an editor. Even if you have partners, I'm sure you did plenty of your own editing in this process. Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate. How did you determine who to invite to participate, and what was that process like?
That is a really wonderful question. There were several ways that people found their invitation in their email box. In some cases, there were certain topics we knew that we wanted covered, and we then looked to see who might be an expert in that particular area. So I'm thinking, for example, we wanted to have someone write about is there any correlation between the advances that happened by having women push through this stained glass ceiling, if you will. Did that have any effect?
I like that. I don't think I heard the stained glass ceiling.
Yeah. I did not coin it, but I use it frequently. And did that have any effect, for example, on other cohorts within the community to find their voice to push through as well? For example, the LGBTQ community. Were they able to take any strength from what we had already done as women? And so it made a lot of sense, for example, to ask our colleague Rabbi Denise Egger, who is the senior rabbi at Congregation Kol Ami in West Hollywood, to write that piece, because she has been so active in the LGBTQ community for so long. We knew we wanted someone to write about issues of healing. So we asked Rabbi Eric Weiss, who is in charge of spiritual healing in San Francisco, to do that. So part of it was driven by, we know we want these issues covered. Who is the best author for those issues? We also knew that there were some people whose writing is just so compelling that we wanted them to contribute in some fashion. In some cases, we allowed them to suggest topics. In other cases, we had some ideas we thought that they would be a good fit for. We have both essays and then also some more personal narratives included. And the personal narratives included, for example, we wanted a wide variety of voices and a wide variety of rabbinates so that people could, people very often think of the rabbinate as being rather monolithic. You are at a synagogue, you get up and you do services and you counsel people and so forth. But really, as you and I both know, the rabbi is much more multifaceted than that now. And so, for example, we wanted a piece by a chaplain. So we had Sarah Schachter, who is a chaplain in the Navy. And we wanted, no, that's not right, in the Air Force, sorry. And so we knew, she was the right person to do that. So, so we wanted the voices to, when they could be the most authentic, having someone write about being a woman in the chaplaincy, we wanted to go and have a woman write that piece. There were some pieces also that that when different colleagues had heard about the project, that they, submitted an idea that they had. And some of those, of course, we can't accept everything. Some were accepted, some weren't accepted. And really tried to make it as well-rounded as we could, and to make certain that there was a balance between pieces that were academic, but also we want people who are not, rabbis or Jewish professionals, just the average Jew in the pew, if you will, to also find something compelling about this book. And so we worked very hard to try to strike a tone so that all of the material is accessible to people. And I think we did. Unfortunately, this is not a book that you toss in your bag when you go to the beach.
Well, unless you need a paperweight, you know.
Exactly, if
it's going to be windy and the bag might be blown away.
You want to keep your blanket from flying away because it clocks in at just under 800 pages.
Right.
And believe me, that was after a lot of cuts. But there were, you know, the essays that are in there really give, really serve to give a very comprehensive look at the impact of women in the rabbinate. And there's a piece in there by Rabbi Chuck Kroloff, talking about sort of his own evolution as a male rabbi, based on the influence of his women colleagues, and we thought that was an important story to hear, because so often we don't focus on the positives, we focus a lot on negatives, and we really wanted someone to talk who had come from a place because of his generation and because of his gender, who really felt powerfully that having women colleagues helped him become a better rabbi. That's an important story to hear. And as our colleague, Rabbi Judith Abrams, who unfortunately died before the publication of the book, she pointed something out so profound in her essay, talking about how our stories as women are vulnerable because we're not the keeper of the stories. Typically, the stories are not told by the women. And so in order to make certain that the stories of women yearning and fighting to find their place and their voice in an arena that had been denied them so long, that if we didn't make certain that the stories get told, that they might fall away and be brushed aside and not become part of the tapestry of the American Jewish story. And that really was the ongoing motivation of this book.
What was the single most surprising thing that emerged in putting together the Sacred Calling?
Well, there were a couple. opening chapters, and it was actually the one that Rabbi Abrams had wrote. She talks about how I'm going to use the word character, but not because this individual is fictional, but this idea of, if you will, of the character of Bruria, and how she became what we know of her is really a construct of what different generations of rabbinic sages wanted to present to us. It's not this one story that this is who her father was, this is who her husband was. She made these couple of statements, and that's the end of the story. But in fact, there was a lot of other information that the rabbis manipulated to try to present her in a certain light. And that was surprising to me, because of course it then made me think, wow, what else has been manipulated in a certain fashion? And then the one other thing, it's actually the following chapter right after that. Rabbi Renee Edelman wrote a piece about Hasidic women rebbes, and these are looking at a couple of women who lived between the years 1749 and 1900. That there were a couple of women, including the daughter of the Baal Shem Tov, who were very, very highly Jewishly educated and functioned in a rabbinic capacity, sometimes because in the case of Adel, the Besht's daughter, when he was away, or eventually when he died, she was the one who actually took over and took on the mantle of his leadership. And I had never heard any of these accounts before. It was certainly never covered in rabbinic school or in any of my readings afterwards. And it was amazing to discover these women and to learn that they had some of the same struggles with finding the balance between what society expects from women and that conflict with those expectations and then their own desire to serve God or to serve the Jewish community in a certain capacity, and how to reconcile those things when they sometimes seem irreconcilable. And those, I think those two were like really the most eye-opening for me. You know, as the editor, I actually have a piece that I wrote in here, and I wrote introductions and things like that. But as the editor, I read many times every single essay that's in here. And so, I mean, I was continually finding and learning new things. And for me, that was one of the ways I could tell as the project was pulling together and all this work we were doing, this particular essay, oh my gosh, yes, this essay really works, because here's someone I'm well educated, I'm well read, I know a lot about Jewish history and a lot about particularly women's issues, and this essay really, really struck me or really moved me or really made me question and think, and that was to me a litmus test, yes, this piece needs to be in the book. And then the one other thing that really has made a lot of news lately is the discovery by my colleague Rabbi Mary Zamor, who is the executive director of the Women's Rabbinic Network.
And a past guest of Two Jewish, and a classmate of mine, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, I know.
And
I
just
saw
a
that,
full disclosure.
Which is great. So, you know, this is a woman of substance. She and her husband discovered that the language on the smicha certificate for women did not match the wording on the smicha certificate for men at HUC, and she writes about sort of the discovery and the whole process of eventually getting to where we are now today, where in fact now this year's was the first class where the language matches on all certificates regardless of gender, and the process. And so there's been this interesting conversation happening, you know, how disappointing it was for some colleagues to discover that even though we in the Reform movement strongly believe in egalitarianism and try to uphold it at every turn, only to discover, hey, the language on our smicha certificates is different, and what are the implications of that, or, you know, philosophically and historically. And so it's been, you know, this wrong has been righted, but it's, I think, has brought up a lot of renewed some conversations amongst colleagues about, you know, how are the ways that we may inadvertently not really promote, but allow there to be, sexism in our community. And it's a good reminder that we need to always be vigilant and making certain that the wording we use is inclusive. And if we do believe that we are equal, then the language should reflect that as well.
I want to thank Rabbi Rebecca Einstein Shore for a great visit here on Two Jewish. The book is called The Sacred Calling. And while it is comprehensive, it's very interesting. And you can get it at the CCR website, and you probably can get it at Amazon. Huh.
You can, if you go onto Amazon.com, I believe they actually redirect you into the CCR portal. But yes, that's a very easy way, since most of us are on Amazon.com, I would say probably at least on a weekly basis.
Thanks so much. Best of luck with continuing to talk about the book and get the word out. And, you know, maybe we'll come to a time when being a woman rabbi is not exceptional.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Rabbi Sally Prezend, the very first woman ever ordained a rabbi in the United States, on the publication of the new book we talked about this morning, The Sacred Calling, and the 40th anniversary of her ordination, or as it turns out, a little more than 40. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli star Yidan Reichel, Lifnei Sheyigamer, Before It Ends. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
לא לפחד להתאהב שישבר הלב לא לפחד בדרך לאבד לקום כל בוקר ולצאת אל החיים ולנסות הכל לפני שיגמר
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.